So let me start just by saying welcome. It's nice to see you all here for a day of practice. And as is my habit, I like to start a little bit formally by chanting the refuges. If you know the refuges, you can chant along with me. If not, just remember that the idea of taking refuge is the idea of going to a place where you feel safe, where things feel okay, that you're not in any way going to be disturbed. Just sort of opening the heart and mind to whatever arrives over the next 8 hours. And I'd also like to remind you, I suppose, that this is a silent retreat, just like as if we were all in the same room. So there will be times when I ask you questions, and I'll ask you if you have questions, and we can speak then. Other than that, I would strongly encourage you to keep silence when we're not online, because we're going to be online some of the time. Some of the time you'll be doing walking practice. Sometimes you'll be off having lunch practice, one of everybody's favorite practice. And during those times, really resist the temptation to chat, to check your phone for messages, all those sorts of things. In fact, if you can, I just unplugged my phone. My phone is turned off for the next 8 hours. If you can, just turn off your phone. Then you won't ever be disturbed for the next 8 hours. Won't that be an interesting day? Just in and of itself, if we didn't have to be in this disturbed for 8 whole hours, it would be great. Okay, anyhow, so that's the plan for the day. So now let's start, as I said, by just chanting the refuges together. Buddham saranam gacchami. Dhammam saranam gacchami, Sangham saranam gacchami, Dutyampi Buddham saranam gacchami, Dutyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami, Dutyampi Sangham saranam gacchami. Tatyampi Buddham saranam gacchami, Tatyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami, Tatyampi So I call this retreat a practicing with beginner's mind. And that's basically going to be, I'm going to be talking about it from various angles all day long and quoting different people. But I want to start just by reminding you that the idea here is to approach your practice as if you had no idea what was going to come next. You have no idea what's happening. This is like, oh, I'm a total beginner. Let's just see what happens. It's kind of refreshing. often when we sit, especially if you've been had practicing for a long time, we sit and we think we know what's going to happen. We sort of have it figured out. And of course, having that expectation, that idea that we know what's going to happen, influences what actually happens, because we have a wrong view. And that view of thinking we know what's going to happen affects what actually happens and affects our practice. Everything is impermanent and changing. And that means that no two experiences, no two sitting periods, no this sitting period and the one later on this morning, they'll be different. It's guaranteed to be different because stuff is going to happen. And the causes and conditions will be such that things will be different later than they are now. different now than they were yesterday, or when you were eating breakfast, or whatever happened before you came here. So that's the key to this, is to just have, see if you can approach the practice with having no idea what's going to happen next. And if you're mindful and you see yourself falling into the pattern of, oh, I know, I this looks familiar, just go, oh. Be mindful of the fact that that's where your mind's going to go, and just notice that tendency to think you know what's going on. That in and of itself is beginner's mind. Just seeing your mind do its thing of being that wise, knowing person who knows what's going on. Because we don't. We don't know what's going on. We don't know what's going to come next. We have no idea. Just practice and see what happens. Also, I want to read something from Sharon Salzberg here as well. And then she's talking about this idea I've been talking about in a certain way. Be patient with yourself in this practice and try not to hold rigid expectations of what you should be experiencing. Strong expectations detract from our capacity for joy and will often lead to more anger. When we have rigid expectations, we can feel a great sense of helplessness if those expectations are not quickly met. We see our actions as being fruitless, not going anywhere, and we get lost in contempt or self-condemnation. Remember that whatever anger, fear, or sorrow arises, or joy, will pass away, and we can always return to the intention to care for ourselves and for all beings. Beginning again and again, and here's the key sentence, beginning again and again is the actual practice, not a problem to overcome, so that one day we can come to the real meditation. It is only due to our concepts that we feel separate from the world. We are isolated by ideas of inadequacy, ideas of danger, ideas of loneliness, ideas of rejection. While we may indeed face external difficulties, our thoughts can amplify them or even create them, leading us deeper into delusion. If we do not want to be enslaved by our thoughts, we can choose to transform our minds. In any given moment, do I choose to strengthen the delusion of separation or the truth of connection? The key thing that I want to point out to, that she's talking about, is not to judge your practice. Oh, I can't do this beginner's mind stuff. We'll all go there sometime today, don't worry. But when you see that, just be aware that, oh, there you are, just no judging. Oh, here I am judging myself again. And let that go. It's just, that's just another thing that's going to get in the way of practicing with beginner's mind. Because now you're lost in some thoughts about how it should be again. I mean, that's what judging is. Judging is saying, oh, I thought it was going to be this way, or I expect it to be this way, or it should be this way, and it's not. If you just notice the judging mind arising, then it's just, okay, now judging mind, and now it's okay. Now that's because that's what's arising. But when you get caught in believing judging mind, that's when the problems are going to arise during the day. So just don't believe any of that stuff that arises. Just notice. Okay, so now we're going to start with just noticing the breath. This is the ultimate beginner's practice, right? And I just want to very quickly go over the traditional form of noting breath. And the idea, first of all, is the breath is the object of meditation. That's what you're paying attention to the exclusion of other things. So we're sort of narrowing our focus, and we're going to concentrate simply on the breath. And to do that, we want to practice something called noting. And noting is basically a way of tethering the mind, bringing the mind closer to what's actually happening, so that you're staying in the moment, just noticing what's actually happening. It's like a beginner is going to know, oh, look, there's my breath. It's going to be a big surprise, okay? And so as we inhale, we'll just note in or rising or inhale. And as we exhale, we'll note out, exhale, falling, dropping, whatever works for you. The rising, falling is like acknowledging there's a physical sensation involved in the breath. The actual noting itself, this is sort of soft, gentle wording, almost like it's in the back of your mind. It's there, but it isn't like in. It's not like a forceful thing at all. It's just there. In, out. So, and we're using that simple bit of words just to keep us, as I said, more connected to what's actually happening. You can also, and this is what the Buddha recommends in the sutta, actually, in the Satipatthana Sutta, you can also notice the quality of the breath. So it could be long, short, soft, loud, shaky. You know, breaths have many different forms, right? So you can sort of note the quality of the breath. If that idea comes to mind as that breath is actually happening. So don't get caught in like, well, I have to figure out what kind of breath this is. Now you're just caught in thinking again, right? But if there's something about this breath that's different from those other breaths that stands out, then use that as the note, because once again, you're then tying yourself a little more tightly to the breath. We're connecting to the breath a bit more firmly. And then, of course, what's really going to happen is we're going to be going in, out, in. Oh, shouldn't have had that breakfast tortilla. whatever it is, you know, the mind's going to go off someplace, right? And then at some point, you're going to notice that the mind's gone off someplace. This is the key moment. This is a moment of pure mindfulness. You actually remember that the word sati, mind, it's often translated as mindfulness, also has a translation of remembering. So at a certain point in the mind wandering, you'll remember what, oh, I'm on a retreat, I'm paying post. Here I am paying attention to the mind. And then you remember, you note thinking, because that's what's happening now, I'm thinking. And you go back to the primary object and just pay attention to what's happening with that breath in that next moment. Without, here's the tricky part, of course, judging yourself. Oh, I can't do this. Oh, and here I am while my mind's wandering again. None of that's relevant. It's just stuff that's going to arise in the mind. And what we're trying to do is remember, narrow our focus and make the object of meditation just the breath, nothing else. We're beginners. This is the first time we've ever done this. And we're just trying to figure out what it's like to really pay attention to the breath using this simple noting technique. Okay, so that's the plan. So now we're going to practice. So in terms of the actual physical form, just remember you want to be upright. You want to be in a position where you're going to be alert and awake, but not rigid. So you want to be comfortable at the same time as you're upright and awake. And I'm going to turn off my mic, and we're going to sit for about half an hour, and then you'll hear the gong go, and that'll be the end of that sitting period, and then we'll continue on from there. So for now, just find your comfortable seated position, whatever that is. You know, close your eyes if that's how you practice, or with your eyes slightly downcast, perhaps. And then just settle in and pay attention to the breath. So let's continue here. The first thing I want to mention is that when I talked about this practice of just having the breath as the meditation object to the exclusion of everything else, this sort of concentrated form of practice, I called it a beginner's practice. And that's true and not true. In fact, there is a whole sutta called the Anapanasati Sutta, which is Mindfulness of Breath Sutta, where the Buddha basically lays out the entire path of awakening based strictly on paying attention to the breath. And he actually, I want to read a little bit of this just so you get a flavor of it. This is just one verse out of this longer sutta. Bhikkhus, when mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it is of great fruit and great benefit. When mindfulness of breathing is developed and cultivated, it fulfills the four foundations of mindfulness. When the four foundations of mindfulness are developed and cultivated, they fulfill the seven enlightenment factors. When the seven enlightenment factors are developed and cultivated, they fulfill true knowledge and deliverance. So he's basically saying, just pay attention to the breath. That's all you need to do. It's sort of interesting to see him say this, because yes, this is a beginner's practice, but yes, it's also a very advanced practice. And finding that how you balance that in your mind is up to you, in a sense. But I guess what I'm suggesting is, if you wanted to, for the rest of today, for the rest of your life, I suppose, your practice could be just paying attention to the breath, nothing else. It would be an interesting experiment, perhaps, even if it's not today, just like some for, you know, a week of your regular practice. Let's go back and be total beginners and do nothing but pay attention to the breath and see what happens. It's just a possibility I'm presenting. And then I'm going to say nothing more about it other than that. Instead, what I want to do is sort of open the doors wide at this point. Take in and note anything that's happening. I mean, if what we're trying to do with this practice is to be aware of what's arising, whatever it is, then we have to sort of have the doors wide open to do that. And the good thing about this idea is that really, at one level, there's only one of six things that can be happening at any moment. There's only, you know, which is like, oh, only six things. It's not too big a list, right? But basically, you know, you're either hearing something, seeing something, smelling something, tasting something, having a bodily tactile experience of some sort, or you're thinking. That's it. That's all that's ever happened, is one of those six, what are called the six sense doors, is open. You are tuned into that sense door, and something arises at that sense door that catches your attention. But that's really all we ever have to note. So the noting could be as simple as hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, feeling, thinking. That would be a perfectly adequate form of practice. Let me, once again, I've the pile of books I have for today is enormous here. I'm just sort of taking them one at a time. So this is from the Samyutta Nikaya, the collected suttas. This is bhikkhus, I will teach you the all. Listen to that. And what, bhikkhus, is the all? The eye informs, the ear and sounds, the nose and odors, the tongue and tastes, the body and tactile objects, the mind and mental phenomena. That is called the all. If anyone, Bhikkhu, should speak thus, having rejected this all, I shall make known another all, that would be a mere empty boast on his part. If he were questioned, he would not be able to reply, and further, he would meet with vexation. For what reason? Because, Bhikkhus, that would not be within his domain. So this is pretty strong language for the Buddha. He's basically saying, anybody who says something different is wrong. This is all there really is. And he's teaching, of course, from his own experience. But that's all that's ever happening, is things are arising at the sense doors. And the breath, which we were using as our meditation object, now just becomes a special case of bodily sensation. And in the form of practice I'm going to suggest, we call the breath the anchor. So you're going to be sitting and things are going to be happening. Things are going to be arising at the sense doors. And something's going to catch your attention and you're going to note it. And it might be just using the sense door name, or just as we did with breath, if there's something about that sensation that immediately comes to mind, like you're hearing something and it might be loud or soft or hummy, you know, there's that refrigerator just turned on and it's hummy, you know, or whatever, it doesn't make any difference. If you have a more descriptive word that you can use for the note, then use that more descriptive word, because that helps us stay a little closer, ties us a little tighter to what's actually arising in the moment. The other thing is that this is passive. In other words, we don't want to be listening. We're simply hearing. Listening is an act of going out and trying to hear something. And we're not trying to, which means we're trying to sort of be in control, right? I want to go and hear something. No, no. We're just going to listen. You know, if something arises at the ear sense door that catches our attention, then we'll note it. But we're not trying to make that happen. We're not trying to give specific attention to that. It's just something arose and I noted it. The other thing is that the content is not important. For instance, you're sitting there and you hear a truck go by outside. Well, you might note hearing, or you might note loud, but you don't want to note big truck going by. Way too much content in the noting. Now you're thinking about what you heard as opposed to just hearing. So it's like we're trying to keep things as simple as possible. Notes typically are like one or two words. That's it. And they're either just noting the sense door or some descriptive flavor to that note. So the last question, and probably the most important and difficult question to deal with, is how do I choose what to note? I mean, I'm having 20 sense impressions a second. If you're a normal person, average mind, about 20 sense impressions a second. How do I choose what to note and what to not note? And so there's a basic rule of thumb that we can follow here. And that's that you note what's most predominant at that moment. So if something sort of stands out above the general stuff that's going on, if it stands out, that's what you note. So if there's a, you know, you're sitting and you, there's a sensation in the body that's quite strong, like all of a sudden, I mean, you notice that your nose is itchy, and you, so you might note itch or itchy. And then you wait 3 or 4 seconds, and then you note what's now what's most predominant. So the noting is has a flow to it. Every 3 or 4 seconds, you just note what's most predominant right now. What stands out above everything else? What? And the tricky part is that because we want to be good at this, we note something, and then we immediately go out starting to figure out what we're going to note next. Now we're planning ahead. It's only 3 or 4 seconds, so that's a lot of time, actually. We're planning, we're trying to figure things out, we're trying to be in control again. As opposed to just note, and now what's important, not note that. And this is a very delicate balance in the practice, where we're trying to not figure things out, not plan ahead, just note what's arising, have a little pause, now note what's arising. One other problem. Often, nothing stands out. It's just like everything is just neutral. There's nothing that's like grabbing your attention in any way at all. At that point, luckily, we've chosen to have this thing called the breath as our anchor. So you just note the breath. In that moment where there's nothing to pay attention to. So don't like, I got to figure out what it is. I got to pay attention. We get all caught up in trying to figure things out again. You know, if nothing stands out, if nothing is like catching your attention, which is often the case, most sensations are pretty much neutral. Blah, neutral. They're just there. You know, they don't have any grab factor. So if nothing's grabbing you, nothing's making you pay really note that, notice that, then just go back to noting the breath. And then 3 or 4 seconds later, now what's going on? And maybe you note the breath again. You know, maybe something is very strong and you might note the same thing 7 or 8 or 9 or 10 times. But remember that everything is going to be changing all the time, and that thing is that's standing out now is going to fade into the background, and something else is going to move into the foreground. It's going to catch your attention more. And so we're not trying to sort of figure out how long should I note this or any of those things. We're just noting what's actually happening right now. This is beginner's mind. This is like, I'm just a beginner. I just want to notice what's happening. Nothing more than that. I just want to pay attention to what's actually happening right now that catches my attention. That's all there is to the practice. He says casually, right? this is where life gets interesting, okay? There's one other thing I want to do before we practice again. One of the issues that often comes up and people, I've heard people say, is that the problem with this whole meditation thing that we're doing is it lacks spontaneity. We're actually being very sort of, we're sitting in a certain way and we're being very focused. And I want to read something I came across about that. This is from Joseph Goldstein's book, Insight Meditation. And it's actually a section conveniently called Spontaneity and Practice. People sometimes pull back from Dharma practice because they fear it will ruin their passion and spontaneity. They question whether mindfulness and spontaneity are compatible or whether one kills the other. This question is quite interesting because it points to a conventional understanding of spontaneity that I think is not really spontaneity at all. We often have an idea that unconsidered, impromptu behavior is spontaneous, and we consider it something pure. But is it? It may be just acting as a slave to conditioning. Is it some great, noble, spontaneous, pure heart creating such actions? Occasionally it may be, but it could just as well be all the habit formations of desire, greed, anger, fear, and confusion causing us to act without reflection. We call that spontaneous. How many times have you found yourself in the middle of doing something before you know that you have even started it? This happens to me more as I get older. I've noticed that. It's like I'll go and I'll be opening the fridge and then I'll go, why am I opening the fridge? Yeah, it's like, but that's a separate issue. Anyhow, that is not spontaneity. It is mechanical behavior like sleepwalking. A truer spontaneity reveals itself very remarkably in the practice. That is the intrinsic spontaneity of all phenomena, of the Dharma, of the whole process of life. When we establish a certain momentum of energy, mindfulness, and concentration, we begin to experience the smooth and rapid flow of all appearances arising and passing by themselves. We are sitting in meditation and a thought comes. Did we invite the thought? Probably not. Sometimes we do, but more often thoughts just arise uninvited. Sensations arise, sounds appear. The more we settle into this process of who we are, this process of the mind and body, the greater is our appreciation for the mystery of it all. There is an awesome grace in this true rhythm of life. Here is an incredible song of the elements singing themselves. This is a far deeper sense of spontaneity, the essence of who we are. How different it is from mechanical, conditioned behavior. So in this sense, mindfulness is actually the key to spontaneity. Interesting. Mindfulness is the key to spontaneity. Mindfulness is the vehicle through which we can open to the continuous, spontaneous arising and passing of all phenomena. So what I'd like you to do in true beginner's mind form is just be spontaneous. I guess that's what we're saying here. Just remember what I said before. What kills beginner's mind is expectation of thinking I know what's going to happen. Oh, I practiced this way for years. I know exactly what's going to happen. That's the opposite of spontaneity. Spontaneity is just being open to what arises and being okay. We'll talk more about that later. Being okay with whatever it is that's arising and just noting it. Just going with the flow of things, as we used to say back in my hippie days. Just go with the flow, man. You know, and then, but that's what we want to do. We just want to let things flow through and note what is predominant at the moment we choose to note. And remember, noting is like every 3 or 4 seconds, we make another note. That's all we need to do. Okay. So once again, you should find your spot for sitting. I'm going to, in a second, mute my mic. And you can just sit. We'll sit for half an hour again. And then at the end of that sitting period, I'll ring my gong and you'll know that period is over. So now we're going to do some more walking practice. But before we do that, I want to point out two things. One is, how does what we just talked about in terms of sitting practice work when we're now doing walking practice instead? And basically, it's pretty much the same thing. We're just opening to what's actually arising. We're, you know, noting what's ever arising at any of the 6 sense doors. Only now we're walking. And so that now the anchor becomes the sensations in the feet, the step, the sensation of stepping, as opposed to the breath. But other than that, the actual process is the same. It's like every 3 or 4 seconds, noting what's most predominant. And when nothing's predominant, just paying attention to sensations of the feet as they land on the ground. I have found in my own practice that walking a little bit slower helps with this idea of paying attention to things in this broader, more open sense. And the flip side of that is if I'm finding I'm quite scattered as I'm walking, and I just pick up the pace, and now I focus right down on the feet and have a simpler practice. So you can, as you're walking, choose in a sense which mode you're going to be working in, and sort of slip back and forth based on what's going on in the moment in your own mind, what the pattern of your mind is at that time. So that's all I have to say about that. It's the same idea, only it's in a different physical form, but it's the same practice. The other thing I want to talk about is what's a favorite topic on every retreat I've ever been on, and that's called continuity of practice. What we tend to do, if we're not careful, is, eventually I'll say, okay, now go walk, right? And you'll get up and you'll sort of figure out where you're going to start your walking practice. You're going to go, and your mind's going to be out there planning where you're going to walk, instead of actually paying attention to what's happening right now. So you could actually note, there you are sitting in your chair, you're about to walk, so you could note standing, turning, stepping, reaching to grab the door handle, turning the door handle, pulling. I mean, you can note everything that's happening. It isn't like there's this space between walking practice and sitting practice that's time off. There is no time off. There's just continuity of practice. The one thing flows into the next. So eventually you'll come back to sit for the next sitting period, and you're just noting everything, and then you sit down, and then you start noting what you're the sensations of sitting, using the breath as the anchor. So that the practice never stops. This is when things start to go deeper in practice, when you can maintain continuity. And it's a matter of remembering, a matter of being mindful of keeping continuity. So I just want to encourage you as best you can for the rest of the day, make the rest of the day one long, continuous practice session without any breaks. And accept the fact, by the way, that that's not always going to be that way, that you are going to space out, that you're going to, things are going to happen, life's going to occur, and we're going to lose that continuity. But as much as we can, we want to remember, oh yeah, continuity of practice, and come back to the practice, and come back. And part of this is like, I'm going to go practice outside. Well, I have to like do all those things, stand up, walk, open door, pull, and then, so if it takes you 2 minutes to get dressed, putting on your shoes and putting on your coat and your scarf and your hat or whatever, who cares? It's not like you're on a schedule. If you want to really pay attention to what's happening, maybe you spend 5 minutes paying attention to what it's like to get dressed. Perfectly good practice. There's nothing special one way or the other about this is what I should be paying attention to, this is not so important. It's all just what's happening now. Let's pay attention to it. And that's all there is to it, really. Okay, So now I would like to suggest that you very mindfully rise from your seats and go do some walking practice. And it's now, I've got 11, 12. Let's get back here at 11:40 and we'll continue on from there. Otherwise, other than that, just go have some spontaneous, wonderful walking practice. I'm going to turn off my mic now. So now the question arises, what gets in the way of this spontaneous beginner's mind practice we've been talking about? What makes us not be open? Typically, one of the most common problems is strong sensations, either strong physical sensations in the body or strong emotional, particularly emotional sensations in the mind. Something comes up that just like is overpowering in some way. We're paying attention and then there's this thing happening in my back or in my knee, or I'm caught up in mentally in some drama. And when these strong sensations arise, and I want to make sure you understand, this could be either pleasant or unpleasant sensations. I mean, strong pleasant sensations can be equally distracting. You're sitting there having this wonderful fantasy in your mind about being in Bermuda on the beach. It could be extremely pleasant and very strong. So, first and foremost, is that we want to remember that these are just things that are arising in the body and mind. There's things that are, they're there, they arise, they're going to be there for a while, and then they're going to be gone. These are just, this is the nature of everything to be impermanent, including these really strong sensations. And so if we just note them, it's like, oh, it's that. They lose some of their power, because what usually happens when strong sensations of this sort arise is we get caught in the story about these sensations. When I was 12, I fell 30 feet out of a tree and landed on my back. And I have a residue of that in my back to this day, almost 60 years later. I still have funny things happen in my back sometimes. And so often on retreat, I would be like sitting and then, this very unpleasant sensation in my back would arise underneath my right shoulder blade. And I would get caught in this space of, oh, here we go again. The rest of the retreat now, I'm going to have this pain in my back. Right? That's where the mind would go. Now I'm not in the present moment at all. I'm worried about the future. I'm caught in worry. I'm caught in all kinds of stories, all kinds of memories of the last retreat and how this went on for days and blah, blah. And we're doing anything but beginner's mind, because we're projected into the future. We're just like we're lost. And so what we have to somehow learn to do is have these strong sensations, either physical or mental sensations, arise, be able to note them. Very important. And then somehow or other, learn to be okay. That's okay. Like that, this is what's happening now. That's okay. It's like being able to accept these things for what they are. They're just strong sensations, strong mental or physical sensations that have often long, complicated, often repeated stories attached to them. And so what we often want, what often happens is if it's an unpleasant sensation, we want it to go away. We're trying to push it away. We get caught in that action. Or if it's really pleasant, then it's like, I want to hang out with this one. We want to keep it, right? Both of which, once again, takes away from just being in the moment and spontaneously in the moment, noting what's actually arising. Now we're clinging, holding on tightly in one way or another. Trying to push something away is just another form of clinging, by the way. Of course, you know, to push something away, we first have to get a really strong hold of it so we can push it away. Whether it's a physical sensation of holding or a mental sensation, we got to cling to something before we can push it away. So instead, if we can note them, accept them, say, well, that's okay. It's like it's not, this isn't like a disaster or a big problem. This is just what's happening right now. And then just hang out with these things. Just like, yes, maybe we note the same thing 20 times in a row. Because that's what, you know, remember the instruction on noting is like, let's note what's predominant. And this is what's predominant right now. This is what's predominant. Then you start to notice that this thing that you thought was like this solid lump, whether it's a physical pain or a solid lump in the mind of like this story that just goes on and on, I've heard it 1,000 times, blah, 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 starts to have shift. It's changing, you know. This pain in my back moves around. When I really pay attention to it, it's like sometimes it's more under the shoulder blade and sometimes it's more in the middle and sometimes it goes up into the neck and some, you know, it's like if I really pay attention to it, it isn't like this solid thing. It's just this thing that's shifting and moving around and it has flavors to it almost. And now this becomes like this interesting thing that you're noticing. Oh, look, it isn't this solid thing. It's shifting around. It's moving. It's this, it's that. You know? And we can sort of hang out with these things and be okay with them because they're not solid. They've lost their solidity, their permanence. We're starting to see that they're not permanent at all. This is just another impermanent phenomena that's arisen. And this is, I'll tell you an interesting story, how I ended up dealing with this thing in my back I was talking about. Is one time I was sitting there, this is like, 2 or 3 days of thing in my back, keep coming back, me pushing away and trying, moving around and wiggling and trying to do all those things you do to get rid of it, right? And instead I just said, okay, the part of the instruction is to sit still, right? So let's just sit still and hang out with this sensation in my back, which was quite intense. And I just sat and let this thing be there and pay attention to it, as I was saying, and seeing it shifting a little bit here and there, but it was there and it was like really strong. And I was just, okay, I'm just going to pay attention to it. I'm not going to move. I'm not going to shift. I'm not going to try and get rid of it. I'm just going to pay attention to it. About 15 minutes later, maybe, I don't know really how long it was. It was a fairly long period of time. You know, the gong goes at the end of the sitting period. And what I notice is how deeply concentrated I've become. Because I've had this thing I've been really paying attention to. I've been totally focused and concentrated. And this thing that was a big problem just became this useful thing that allowed me to go deeper into concentration. Oh, here's a different perspective on exactly the same thing. It was like, oh, this isn't a problem. This is a good thing. It's like my mind shifted about it. And then it would come back and sometimes it would still be annoying, but now it wasn't a big deal anymore. It's never been a big deal since then, as a matter of fact, because I got to the place where it's like, I could accept it and just, oh, so this is what I got right now. That's okay. A lot of the problem with those strong physical sensations is we sort of tighten up around them. We make them into this big thing that's going to be there forever. Oh, no. As opposed to just like, well, that's what's there now. It's okay. It sort of being relaxed and sort of being open to it makes a huge difference. Having said this, now I'm speaking specifically about bodily issues. Remember, the instructions for sitting are always the same. Sit still. And stillness of body leads directly to stillness of mind. This is very true. I've experienced this in my own practice many, many times. So the longer I can sit still physically, the stiller my mind goes, the more focused my mind becomes. But so when is it wise to move? I mean, if I've got this really strong physical sensation, is there times when doing what I just suggested, like hanging out with it and being really curious about it, is actually not skillful? And now I'm speaking from my 38 years of teaching yoga here, so a little different perspective perhaps. But if that pain, that strong physical sensation is in a joint, in your knee, in your hip, in your neck, and it's like right in the joint itself, move, because you're damaging the joint. I know there's so many people I know who have taken up this form of, you know, practice and have been very, quote, serious sitters who've had knee replacement surgery because they didn't move when they should have. So you'd be surprised how many, quote, advanced practitioners also have had knee surgery. It's quite shocking, actually, because they said, oh, no, I'm just supposed to sit here. And if it's painful, it's painful. I'm going to sit here anyway, because that's what the instruction are, is to sit still and just pay attention. Right? Sometimes it's actually quite skillful to move, especially if, as I said, the strong sensation is in a joint in the body. But then you can still move and be totally mindful. You can sort of, before you move, there's always an intention. There's a mind state of intention. A mental formation of intention to move arises before the actual moving. So see if you can see the intention arise. And then very consciously note all the things that are happening as you move, both on the mental level and on the physical level. You know, where you start to move and now your, you know, judgment, or, oh, I'm moving, I shouldn't be moving, what's wrong with me? You know, some sort of judgment, mental process, or just like the physical, as the body moves, there's all this sensation, and now you've got something interesting to note. And now you've got continuity of practice, only you happen to be moving as you're, instead of just sitting still. It's okay. It's better that than damage your body. So that it's a fine line what I'm talking about here, but we all have to find it. But I just want, this is like I'm waving my yellow warning flag here about sitting with painful body sensations in particular. So the last thing I want to mention about strong sensations, which are the distractions to staying focused, is when we're noting, we have to be careful not to use overly strong words, because the words themselves, the words we use, so if you're noting and there's some strong sensation in your knee or your back, You don't want to note pain. You want to might note strong. You might want to note throbbing or something like that. But the word, like, you don't want to use the word pain or some word like that, agony, because that sets off a mental process of, oh God, that's bad. So if we can note those strong sensations as strong or some word that describes them without making them into a drama, that's a skillful way to deal with this stuff. Similarly with positive, wholesome, wonderful sensations. It's like, you know, we don't want to go, oh, bliss, you know, because now it's like, once again, now we're turning it into something more than it is. It's just this physical sensation or this mental arising. It's all that it is. So it's trying to avoid noting that has dramatic content around these stronger sensations is a skillful way to work with them within the context of what we're doing here today. Okay, so that's what I have to say about strong sensations. It's important that I do this because it's something when you're on retreat, we always end up in this place. Sooner or later, either a strong mental story or a strong physical sensation is going to arise. This is a skillful way to deal with it in this beginner's mind context of, like, you want to be curious about it. You know, beginners are curious, right? Oh, well, what's that? And what's it like to actually hang out with this? And that curiosity is quite useful and has that beginner's mind set to it. Okay, meanwhile, let's once again find our comfortable seated positions, however you want to do that. And we're going to once again sit for about half an hour. So, as always, once you've found that comfortable position, I'm going to once again, turn off my mic now, and we'll sit. So now it's time for lunch practice. And notice what I said there. This is not lunch time. It's not lunch break. It's lunch practice. I want to stress that even though we're not going to be together for the next 45 minutes or so, that you should keep the practice going. Remember, continuity of practice. This is a time where we often kind of space out, right? So how can we do that? And at the same time, maintain this idea of beginner's mind. Well, if you're like me, you either prepared a lunch or you sort of know what your lunch is going to be. You thought about it a little bit because you knew you didn't have a lot of time to run around and get lunch. And if you're like me, then you probably made it out of some of your favorite things. You know, I've got a sandwich and I've got a salad and I got a piece of pie. Oh boy, it's like, oh great. So here's the trick. Can you, number one, really note all the sensations of eating? Because when you think about eating, this is where the senses really get excited. It's like there's the smell of the food, the taste of the food, the sight of the food, the texture of the food as you chew and swallow. I mean, there's so much wonderful tactile information to pay attention to. But since you're doing this with beginner's mind, can you eat that lunch as if you've never eaten any of those foods before? Like, this is the first time you ever ate a piece of apple pie in my case. Wow. Can I just be that simple about it? Approach the eating from that space of beginner's mind. It'll may take you a while longer to eat, and but I suspect you'll probably enjoy it a lot more. And then after you've eaten, it's time for, we are going to be, I'm going to give you about 45 minutes. So you're going to have a bit of time after you've actually physically eaten. It might be time to go outside for a walk. It might be time to do a little yoga. It might be time to take a little nap. Whatever suits you or your nature and how you're feeling right now. If you're feeling kind of low energy, maybe just, kicking back and having a little nap or something in a big comfy chair might be exactly what you need to do right now. Or maybe going outside, it's sunny, let's go outside and walk around in the sun for 20 minutes. Actually go for a walk, but do it all mindfully. So it's now 12:30. I'll come back and we'll continue at 1:15. Other than that, as they say where I come from, bon appetit. So let us continue talking about beginner's mind. And this afternoon, I want to sort of approach that from a couple of different angles within the context of the practice. Basically, beginner's mind is being open to many possibilities, being able to practice with no expectation of what's going to happen next. Being able to sort of practice with an I don't know attitude. The problem with this is it's kind of scary. This idea of not knowing, of not being in control of what comes next, of not even knowing what comes next, can be make us feel quite uncomfortable, maybe even frightened. And that's because at some level, we want to be in control. We want to have that structure of being in control. But how can I be in control if I don't know what's coming next? How can I be prepared? I mean, being in control, part of being in control is like being prepared, being ready, right? How can I be that way if I don't know what comes next? If I'm just taking in what's actually happening and that's all. The problem with being in control or trying to be in control, I think, which is more accurate, is it's the opposite of mindfulness. It's the opposite of beginner's mind and having an open mental space. It just doesn't work. When we're trying to control our experience, we aren't open to the present moment because we already know what comes next, or we think we know what's coming next, or we want it to be a certain way. And in the wanting, we're caught in not seeing what's actually happening. So when we're trying to be in control, we are quite consciously, or perhaps unconsciously, limiting the possibilities of what can actually arise and what we can possibly notice. So this is a central problem of the practice. And part of this is very deeply cultural, I think. Our culture basically says that we should be in control. That, you should be in control all the time. You should be the one in charge. You're your own boss, blah, blah, blah. We should have control over our life and also control of our minds. And the truth is we aren't at all. or very, very little. We're not in control of our minds at all. And often we take this practice to be a way we can somehow learn to be in control of our minds. And this is not the intent of the practice. In fact, it's the opposite of what the intent of the practice is. Basically, what arises in our mind on a moment-to-moment basis is pretty much random. It's just stuff arises. And then another thing arises, and then another piece of stuff. And it's just totally random. We have absolutely no control over that, or almost none at all. It's basically just causes and conditions are such that this thing arises in the mind. You know, we're you know, walking down the street and someone is walking by the other way, but they're wearing a perfume that reminds us of someone. And then we're caught in the memory of that person and the mind's gone into that whole story about that person. Totally random. All we just had this that momentary sense impression of, you know, Chanel number 5 or, you know, Brut or whatever that smell was. And the mind's gone. Just like that. Totally at random. This, we really have no control over our minds at all in terms of what is going to arise next. And we have a bit more control over our lives because we have some control over our physical bodies. But that, even that's pretty minimal. And this is, when I first sort of realized this, it was like, what a scary thought that I can't control my mind. Because that's what I'm supposed to do. But when you think about it, it's kind of a relief. It's like, I'm not responsible for all that nonsense that keeps popping up in my mind all the time. You know, all this stuff that arises is just stuff that's arising. I'm not to blame. I'm not responsible. I'm not, you know, I don't need to judge myself for the fact that I have these really weird fantasies about XYZ, whatever your favorite kind of weird fantasy is, or these unwholesome thoughts about someone or something. It's just, that's what arises. We have no control at all. So what does that mean in terms of the practice? Well, why are we practicing if we're not trying to control the mind? What is this practice all about? And really, this practice is about learning skillful, wholesome ways to deal with and react in wholesome ways to what is actually arising. Like stuff arises and how we react to what's arising. That's where we have control. That's where we can learn to skillfully work with all this random stuff that just keeps popping up on our brains and in our bodies. And that's what the practice is really all about. It's about learning to be skillful about how we react to what's arising so that we don't get caught in unwholesome spaces of mind and which often lead to unwholesome acts of body and speech, that we don't cause more suffering just because this junk's arrived, it just arose in my mind, that we can look at it and go, oh, I know, I see what that is. I can be mindful of it. I can be totally okay with the fact that my mind right now is full of this nonsense. It's just because I had no control over that stuff arising. So I'm not to blame. Whew. Thank goodness I'm not to blame for all that, right? It's a different way to look at it. I'm not in control at all of what arises. I have some control over how I react. And as I learn to be more skillful, more mindful, I have more control on that level. Not on what's arising, but on my reactions to the arising. That's what I'm trying to learn to do in this practice. The thing with control, with this desire for control, is that it arises because unpleasant things arise and we want to get away from them. We should be able to be in control and get away from that stuff, avoid it, not have to deal with it. That's one place where this desire for control arises over and over and over again. The other place that arises is because we have this idea that we're supposed to be going somewhere, that this practice goes somewhere, some place in our, you know, and we have this idea in our mind of what that place is. And, you know, it's some blissful, wonderful place probably. And that we should somehow be able to have enough control to get ourselves there, wherever there is. Well, here's the other piece of bad news, in a sense. We don't have a clue where there is. We really have no clue at all. We might have read interesting things in books about what it means to be realized or a stream enterer or whatever. But unless we're actually there, we don't know where there is. We have no ground to understand that. So all we can do is practice and be open to what's arising. And sometime, someday, there will become more real, more this is what they were talking about in that book, or that teacher was talking about, or whatever. That's the potential. And the there is basically a place where more and more often we react skillfully to what's arising, and we're not swept away by what's arising, either by trying to push it away or trying to hold on to it and make it into something. We're just there, hanging out, being mindful, and seeing what happens. That's all we're trying to do. This isn't easy because it goes so much against our human nature and so much against our cultural teaching. But this is where we have to go with this practice. This is where we need to let go of those ideas of we should be in control and we should know where we're going, because we don't know either of those things. We don't have control and we don't know where we're going. I'm not saying that you shouldn't have some sort of intent to go towards someplace, even if we don't know where that someplace is. That's the tricky part. Our intention is to become enlightened beings. And that's why we do the practice. That's the reason to do the practice. And we have to have that intention very clearly in our minds, even if we don't really understand what an enlightened being is, other than some vague feelings we might have had at some time in our practice. I mean, because we all have moments of enlightenment. I mean, every one of us here has had a moment of enlightenment at least once today already, maybe many times. It just happened to be very brief, and we're trying to just gradually get them to be closer together and more of that and less of the other. So we have sort of an inkling of what it means to be an enlightened being. But we don't really know. And all we can do is practice, and gradually we'll know more. And that's about the only control we have, is to choose to practice. That we do have control over. That's where the control, if there's any control at all, it's in making that choice over and over and over again. As I read in that thing that Sharon said earlier on today, this practice is all about starting over again and again and again, with that clear intention being the motivation that keeps us starting over and over again. Okay. As usual, I have a piece of poetry that explains this better than I can. So this is from Dana Fald's book, Go In and In. It's called Allow. There's no controlling life. Try corralling a lightning bolt, containing a tornado. Dam a stream and it will create a new channel. Resist and the tide will sweep you off your feet. Allow and grace will carry you to higher ground. The only safety lies in letting it all in, the wild with the weak, fear, fantasies, failures, and success. When loss rips off the doors of the heart, or sadness veils your vision with despair, practice becomes simply bearing the truth. In the choice to let go of your known way of being, the whole world is revealed to your new eyes. I'll read that last sentence again. In the choice to let go of your known way of being, the whole world is revealed to your new eyes. That pretty much describes what we're doing here. So, I guess it's time to practice some more. So, once again, find your comfortable seat, and we'll practice for about a half hour or so. So you want to be sitting up erect, awake, alert, but not in control. It's really something you might want to even try and note for the rest of the day. When you see yourself starting to control or wanting control over what's happening, just note that. And the note might be simply as controlling or trying to control. It's, as you see that more and more, it's easier and easier to let go of that desire to be in charge, to control, to be the one who's holding on to the reins. And then we'll just sit for about half an hour. I'm muting my microphone. So at this point, we're going to go do some more walking practice, but I want to, before you do that, just suggest a totally different way of noting while you're walking. And that's what's called four-step noting, or sometimes called open noting. And this form sort of acknowledges the fact that in walking practice, there's a lot more going on than just the sensations in your feet. In particular, there's three other things that are going on. One is the physical sensation of the body as a whole, moving through space. There's things you see and things you hear. These are all things that can predominate because we're out in the open, we have our eyes open, we're sort of more open. Even hearing is like, I noticed that when I'm walking outside with my boots on, I can hear the clunk of my boots on the cement. When I was at IMS, did a whole walking practice out in a blizzard, and the sound of the snow crunching under my boots was so predominant, it was like it took over everything else. So what this form does is it allows you to sort of have a bit wider open form of noting. And the idea here is that you start and you walk, you know, your 20 paces along that line. And the first time you, like you walk in one direction, as you're walking, you're simply noting stepping, 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 stepping until you get to the end. And then you turn around and you're walking back the other way. But now you're noting moving, because you're trying to, now you're sort of opening up and noting the larger sense of the body moving through space than just the sense of the feet touching the ground. Some people like to choose a point, like I often sort of focus on my heart center going forward. Some people use the belly, some people use the throat, whatever works for you. You know, just sort of experiment a little bit and see where this, the sense of moving so obvious. And then you stop, you get to the end of that line of 20 paces, you stop, you turn around, and then you note seeing. Because when you're out there and your eyes are open and you're practicing, you're obviously seeing a lot. So now you're actually going to acknowledge that and let the focus be on the seeing sense. Seeing, seeing. And you might even, you know, lift your head and look around a little bit, but not too much, but like really pay attention to what you're seeing. There's a lot out there, right? Even if you're just walking in your house, walking down the hallway, you're still noticing, oh, maybe a little bit of art on the wall, or, oh, look at this, look at that. You know, that, gee, the light falling on that piece of furniture over there, isn't that interesting? You know, there's lots to see. And then you get to the end of that 20 paces, you stop, you turn around, and then for the next 20 paces, you note hearing. So let the hearing sense be the predominant thing. And you note hearing, and you're actually hearing what's all the sounds around you. I've been practicing outside, and we have birds chirping, and, you know, cars going by on the street outside, blah, 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 lots of stuff going on out there. Like I said, the sound of my boots on the cement. I get to the end of that set of 20 paces, I stop, I turn around, and I'm back to stepping. So it's just each set of 20 paces is one of these four things in sequence, and then you just cycle through these over and over and over again. So you're sort of acknowledging the wide open, larger context of walking practice. I have found this for myself very useful form of noting, and it sort of keeps my interest in walking much more. And sometimes I want to do that more concentrated form of just the sensation in the feet, you know, lifting, placing. You can even do lifting, moving, placing. Each step is three notes if you're going really slowly. So that's a very concentrated, focused form. This is sort of the wide open form of noting. Not one better than the other. Feel free to experiment. This is, once again, beginner's mind. If you've never walked this way before, it's kind of interesting to see what happens. It's a way to be a beginner again in this new form of noting. So now at this point, oh, it's 2:08 already. Oh my God. So we're going to go walk until 2:35. So I'm going to turn off my mic. You can all very mindfully and keeping continuity go and do your walking practice. I'll see you at 2:35. So here we are again, and I want to talk about another aspect of this idea of practicing with a beginner's mind. And basically, practicing with beginner's mind, in one sense, means just accepting the way things are, which is not something we often want to do. But when we do, when we practice in this way of just accepting what's happening, that's when it's like we come alive. That's when we get energized. It's like we're just saying, you know, sometimes things are great, sometimes things aren't. Sometimes Sometimes things are pleasant, sometimes things are unpleasant. And that's just life. This is like the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows. And I want to read you something. This is from a book called Direct Realization. It's a collection of talks by Ajahn Sumedho, who is the abbot of a Theravada monastery in England, and has many wise words. And this is on the theme I just mentioned, called Accepting the Way Things Are. How many of you have been practicing today trying to become something? I've got to do this or become that or get rid of something or got to do something. That compulsiveness takes over, even in our practice of Dhamma. This is the way it is. Isn't a fatalistic attitude of not caring or being indifferent, but a real openness to the way things have to be at this moment. For example, right now, at this moment, this is the way it is, and it can't be any other way at this moment. It's so obvious, isn't it? Right now, no matter whether you are feeling high or low or indifferent, happy or depressed, enlightened or totally deluded, half enlightened, half deluded, three quarters deluded, one quarter enlightened, hopeful or despairing, that's the way it is. It can't be any other way at this moment. This doesn't mean we can't try to make things better, but we do so from understanding and wisdom rather than from an ignorant desire. How does your body feel? Just notice that the body is this way. It's heavy, it's earthbound, it's coarse, it gets hungry, it feels heat and cold, it gets sick, sometimes it feels very nice, sometimes it feels horrible. This is the way it is. Human bodies are like this. So this tendency to want them to be otherwise falls away. The world is this way. Things happen. It snows and the sun comes out. People come and go. People have misunderstandings. People's feelings get hurt. People grow lazy or inspired, depressed or disillusioned. People gossip and disappoint each other. There's adultery, theft, drunkenness, and drug addiction. And there are wars, and there always have been. Here in a community like Amaravati, that's the Wat that he was the abbot of, we can see the way things are. Now it's the weekend, when more people come to offer alms food, and it's more crowded and noisy. There are people pounding vegetables and chopping things, with everything going all over the place, and sometimes there are children running up and down screaming. You can observe, this is the way it is, rather than think, these people are impinging on my silence. I don't want it to be like that. I want it to be otherwise. Might be the reaction if you like the quiet orderliness of the meal when there's none of this activity and there are no loud noises or harsh sounds. But life is like this. This is the way life is. This is human existence. So in our minds, we embrace the whole of it. And this is the way it is, allows us to accept the changes and movements from the silent to the noisy, from the controlled and ordered to the confused and muddled. One can be a very selfish Buddhist. Interesting line. Huh? One can be a very selfish Buddhist, wanting life to be very quiet and to be able to practice with plenty of time for sitting, plenty of time for studying the Dhamma and thinking, I don't want to have to receive guests and talk to people about silly things. I don't want to, blah, blah, blah. You can be a very, very selfish person as a Buddhist monk. You can want the world to align itself with your dreams and ideals. And when it doesn't, you don't want it anymore. But rather than make things the way you want them, the Buddha's way is to notice the way things are. It's a great relief when you accept the way it is, even if it's not very nice, because the real misery is not wanting it to be like that. Isn't that last line, I think, is real. It's a great relief when you accept the way it is, even if it's not very nice, because the only real misery is not wanting it to be like that. It's how we cause all our own suffering, and also how we end up practicing with something other than beginner's mind by not just accepting this is the way it is. I mean, how often do we get caught up in trying to make things some way other than the way things are? How often do we get caught up in wanting to fix things so that it's better? We want to have these sort of perfect conditions for practice. We want to have this perfect conditions for life, let alone practice. And it's never going to be that way. Sometimes it'll be wonderful and sometimes it's not. And we have to both accept that when it's not, but also, and this is interesting, we have to accept the wonderful. Sometimes when things are wonderful, we get caught in the space of, oh, but I don't deserve this. This is going to go away soon. And both of those are just being caught in not just accepting things as they are. Right now it's wonderful. Isn't this great? Really enjoy it. But don't worry about it not lasting. Don't worry about, I'm not good enough to experience this wonderful experience. That's just delusion intruding on your life and not just accepting the way things are. And that's one of the keys to practicing with the beginner's mind, is just saying, this is the way things are, and that's okay. It's a phrase I've really been working with for a long time now, for several years, is being able to say, no matter what's happening, if I can just say, and that's okay. Whether it's just some craziness in my mind or something that's happening in my life. I mean, look at what's happening in our lives right now. It's like we can either fight against this whole thing of having to be socially isolated and wait in line for a vaccine and all those things we have to do, or we can just go, and that's okay. I mean, this is what we got right now, and make the best of it and enjoy it. I mean, in some ways, you might think this rather is an odd thing to say, but it's like, boy, all this time we've been in seclusion. What a luxury. Think of it that way. Like, isn't it great that we've been able to practice in seclusion so much lately? This is like perfect conditions. Isn't this great? As opposed to, but I can't go to my favorite restaurant, or, I got to put on the stupid mask every time I go to the grocery store. You know, all those things we complain about all the time, not accepting the way things are. It's just shifting how we look at it, just accepting things the way they are, and doing what we can to make sure it doesn't get worse, like always wearing a mask and keeping social distance, all those things we've been encouraged to do. We can do all that, but it's just the way things are. Okay. So that's really all I have to say at this point. So now, guess what? Let's do some more sitting practice. What a good idea. The way things are right now is we're going to sit some more. So once again, finding your comfortable formal seat, wherever that happens to be. Sitting up straight. If you're starting to get a little tired, which some people do just by this point in the day, just take a few extra deep breaths before you start. Sometimes just those deep breaths will energize you. It'll sort of shift and you'll accept the fact that I'm a little tired, but it's okay. Even that's okay. And then I'll mute my mic and we'll sit for about half an hour. So here's the plan for the rest of the day. In a minute, I'm going to set you off to do some more walking practice, your last walking practice of the day. And then after that, I will talk one more time. I have one more angle of approach to this idea of practicing with the beginner's mind I want to talk about. And we'll sit one more time. And then at the end of all of that, there'll be some time for questions and comments and discussion and general closing stuff. So that's the plan. So for right now, just whatever form your walking practice is taking, now's the time to go do it. Remembering, please, please, please remember continuity of practice. So don't stop practicing just because you're going someplace to walk. Keep practicing all the time. Have a nice walking practice. And so we'll come back here at 20 minutes to 4, so 3:40. So there's one more way I want to look at this thing we've been discussing all day. This, we've been looking at it from this angle and that angle. And I want to look at it from the angle of a very traditional part of the Buddhist teaching, which is the seven factors of awakening. Because as I was preparing this program, it struck me that they're very much, especially the beginning parts of it, are very much talking about practicing with beginner's mind. So I'll go through the beginning parts of the seven factors of awakening. And this is sort of, these are sort of a description of the progressive stages the mind goes through as we move towards awakening. And the seven factors of awakening start. The first of the seven factors is mindfulness, which we've been talking about all day, right? So once you've developed mindfulness, once mindfulness has actually arisen, and remember that mindfulness is a mental formation. It's just it's a mind state that arises, just like any other mind state. And it's there for a while, and then it's gone. That's the nature of mindfulness, just like it's the nature of everything else. So mindfulness isn't something you practice, which is, we have to be careful with the language here. It's, mindfulness is an actual mind state that arises if you practice in a certain way that creates the causes and conditions such that mindfulness might arise, which is what we've been doing. So we've been practicing creating causes and conditions. And then mindfulness arises. And then, once mindfulness has arisen, then these three factors I want to talk about arise in succession. And the first of these three is called Dhammavacaya, which usually is translated as investigation. And I'm not crazy about that translation, but I've never come across a better one. And it's because in English, investigation implies thinking, figuring things out. And that's not what we're talking about here. Investigation here is more an intuitive process. It's more has to do with wisdom than knowledge. You know, wisdom is something that we acquire through insight, whereas knowledge we acquire through study. They're both useful things to do, but we're talking about something that's more wisdom oriented. And what we're investigating as we start to really pay attention in mind and our mind, we're in this state of mindfulness, is we start to see not so much the details of what's arising. We're not paying so much attention to, oh, my knee hurts, oh, there's a sound, oh, this, oh, that. But instead, we're starting to see the underlying nature of reality, the underlying nature that is there no matter what. Each of us has a different experience of what's arising, but all of us have exactly the same process of experience going on all the time. And we start this idea of investigations is start to sort of shift our awareness away from the details, the content of what's arising, and more to pay attention to the process that underlies it. In particular, the first thing we'll notice when we start paying attention to the process is that everything, no matter what it is, whether it's a thought or a physical sensation or an emotion or a, who knows, a sound, things arise, they're there for a while, and they're gone. Everything is of that nature. And we start to see that. We start to experience that that's the underlying process. Things are just arising, they're there for a while, and then they're gone, which is a pretty good description of impermanence. One of the three central things we have to understand and come to insight into. We have to realize that this isn't just a theoretical construct that we understand on an intellectual level. This is something we can actually experience, that we're actually experiencing all the time. We just don't notice. And once we start to see impermanence, then we'll have start to have an intuitive insight into the second of these factors, unsatisfactoriness. If nothing is permanent, if everything is changing all the time, then there's nothing, nothing that can make us permanently happy, because it's always going to disappear, no matter what it is, whether it's an emotion or a thing, or doesn't make any difference. Things arise, they're there for a while, they're gone. And we also start to see the fact that that's all that's happening. Things are arising and therefore while they're gone. There's no self. So we start to have an intuitive understanding of not self, the third of these three things we have to have see through insight. We start to have an experience of the fact that there's just stuff arising and passing away. There's no self there at all. The self we sort of imagine on top of what we're experiencing, but it's not actually there. It's just something we imagine. So the beauty of this Dhammavacaya, this state, and this is also Dhammavacaya in itself is a mind state that we'll see arise. We'll see this sort of layer of intuitive noticing that's below the surface of content. And we'll actually see it arise. And we can actually note it, just like we can note mindfulness has arisen. We can note, Dhammavacaya is here. Because we see that the quality of what's going on has shifted from content to process. This is also, by the way, considered the main antidote to doubt. When we start to see at this level, doubt just disappears. Because we're seeing that what the Buddha taught is true. And it's not something that we're just accepting intellectually, it's something we're actually experiencing on an intuitive level. Okay, so then now once mindfulness is present and Dhammavacaya is active, then what happens next is virya, which is often translated as energy, also translated sometimes as effort. So here we are in the sixth step of the Eightfold Path, right effort, wholesome effort. But now it's something that we experience, this rising of energy. It's like the practice becomes effortless, because there's this the mind, presence of mindfulness, and in this presence of this process of investigation of intuitive seeing, creates this energy in a sense. So now this energy is just bubbling over in our practice. It's this, by the way, is an antidote to sloth and torpor, that sense of, you know, I can't do this any longer. I've had it. I've had the biscuit for the day. When virya is arising, it's like you can't. It's just like, oh boy, all this juicy energy is there. It's a distinct sensation of like momentum picking up. Other translations of virya, by the way, are strength and courage. Courage, I think, is an interesting one. This is like, to do this practice, to really go deep into this practice, takes courage. It's difficult. It's not, it's like we have to focus and dedicate ourselves to the practice, which is courageous, and because to do that, and we have to be able to look at all the stuff we don't want to look at. You know, we've talked about that a lot today. And also we just have to like, okay, this is more important than anything else. This takes courage. The tricky thing about virya energy is that it has to be kept in balance. If it gets too strong, we start overdoing it, we can actually sort of end up striving, like, oh, I'm gonna just keep going and keep going and keep going and keep going and exhaust ourselves, literally, physically exhaust ourselves. So we have to be mindful of this energy, not to let it sort of amp us up too much. We have to have a balance of energy and calm, in a sense. And there's one of the aspect of this I want to talk about. And this is from Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness. And he talks about something he calls spiritual urgency. And this is him writing about these seven factors of awakening. The proximate cause for the arising of virya is a factor of enlightenment, is the feeling of spiritual urgency. The Buddha talked of attending to these awakening factors as a matter of vital concern and not simply as something to do in our off hours. There are some powerful reflections that remind us of this urgency. We can reflect on the preciousness of our present circumstances. Whether we think in the context of many lives or just in this life, we can see and appreciate how rare it is for all the conditions to come together in order for us to hear the Dhamma, and even more so for us to have the interest, motivation, and opportunity to practice. We often think that conditions will always be favorable, but any look at the world around us reveals the truth of uncertainty, from war and violence to natural disasters to our own aging bodies. Wise reflection on the uncertainty of conditions heightens the appreciation of our present circumstances and thus becomes the cause for the arousal of energy. Reflecting on death is another powerful reminder to use the time of our lives in a way that benefits ourselves and others. Each day, life gets shorter. Day by day, life is running out. Can we hold this truth in our awareness as a way of arousing spiritual energy? Does it inspire us? Does it frighten us? The Buddha would often exhort the bhikkhus, there are trees and roots of trees. Meditate now, lest you regret it later. Like, there's a good spot to sit right there. Go sit. We can also reflect that the end of all accumulation is dispersion, and to look to see what we spend so much time accumulating. It might be wealth and possessions, or people and relationships, or projects and great works. Although all of these things might be of some benefit, the great Indian adept Shantideva reminds us, and fix this firmly in your understanding. All that may be wished for will by nature fade to nothing. Sounds almost grim, but it's actually, this is the truth of life. This is the way things are. I had a I had a teacher once named Swami Vishnudevananda, and he used to, this is when I was younger, and he used to have this question he would ask. You know, we'd all be gathered together, a bunch of students and him speaking, and he'd say, what's the difference between yesterday and today? And if we knew the answer, we weren't allowed to say it out loud, right? So new people would have to answer. And some people say, oh, you know, yesterday was Wednesday and today's Thursday. Or, you know, it was sunny yesterday and today it's cloudy. Or, you know, they'd give all these sort of answers like this. And he'd say, no, no, no. The difference between yesterday and today is today you're one day closer to death. And everybody would go, oh, Swamiji, you know, we were all young and fit. And it would be like, oh, what a downer, right? But he was just trying to inspire spiritual urgency in us. He was trying to wake us up and think, you never know what's going to happen. Now's the time to practice. Do it now. Now's the time to practice spiritual urgency. So this is as this sense of, oh my God, this is how lucky I am to be in this situation where I can spend the whole day not having to worry about anything other than the fact that I can practice all day. How fortunate we are that we can do this. It's incredible when you think about it. Most of the people in the world don't have this luxury at all. You know, people, as much as I'm not particularly happy with how things are in this country right now, think of how fortunate we are to live in the country where it's possible for us to live the way we live. That's like, wow, it's amazing. And that's what gives us energy, so that we have this fortune right now. Let's take advantage of it. Ah, which leads to, so now we have mindfulness established. We're investigating. We're looking at the underlying process. We're full of energy. Then the fourth of these factors, pity arises. Pity is often translated as rapture, which I'm not crazy about the translation, because rapture has that whole association of sort of uncontrolled going into the raptures, you know, and that's not what we're talking about here. Also, another translation is joy, which is closer to how I feel comfortable. But it's like, I think the best translation might be something like intense, joyful interest. It's like we're practicing, we're seeing these things, we're full of energy, and it's like at some level we're going, wow, isn't this amazing? Isn't this wonderful? We're like just caught up by how great it is. This joy literally bubbles over. We're just so involved in the practice, and just everything we see, it, you know, it's like, oh, look, there's another breath. Isn't that amazing? You know, it's like, it's not just like, oh, there's another breath. It's like, all of a sudden, it's like fascinating to watch another breath. It can become special somehow. And pity often has associated with it very strong physical sensations that are quite pleasant, by the way. When pity arises, often quite pleasurable body senses arise as well. And that's one thing you have to watch for, is that you don't sort of get caught up in this wonderful feeling of what's going on, so groovy, and think that you've reached the end of the practice, because it's so sweet. It's so pleasant. That now you start practicing to have that pleasant feeling again. It's not. It's just a step along the way. And that's the danger of pitti, is that it's so pleasant, it makes you want to just hang around in it. Not that you shouldn't enjoy it. Very important. I mean, if we can, we have to enjoy our practice. Very important that we enjoy our practice, as a matter of fact. But it's not like to the extent that we start making that the reason we practice. The other thing I want to point out is that this pleasant state of mind, this joy, this happiness, is different. There's another word in Pali that you come across, sukha. You know, dukkha is suffering, sukha is happiness. You know, these are like the two sides of that coin. But sukha is also often translated as joy or happiness, but sukha is worldly happiness, things that, you know, happen in our lives, in our world, that make us happy. You know, a good meal, a beautiful sunset, a wonderful painting, you know, things that we just, oh, I'm so happy, you know, a good chat with a friend. You know, that's like, it just, that's sukha. Pitti is purely happiness that arises at the mental level. This is purely a mental factor. There is no external thing that's causing us to feel happy. So this is a difference that's important to understand, because it's a different quality of joy, a different quality of happiness that arises at this point in the practice. Once mindfulness is present, we're investigating, energy is rising, then this rapture, this pitti will arise. All of these things have, of their nature, I think, something to do with beginner's mind, in the sense that it's like we're like awake and alive. This is like when these things are active, it's like you're really perky, might be the best word I can use. And these are all things that you can note. I mean, you can actually see these things arising in your practice and note them. Be aware of them. Accept them. Enjoy them. Because this is the beauty. This is where the beauty of the practice becomes more and more evident as these things arise. Now, one last thing. The danger of all of this, of course, is that we get over-energized. We get too rapturous. You know, we get too lost in looking at the details, the underlying stuff. And so the last three factors, which I'm just going to mention very briefly, are sort of the balancing factors that arise after all of this is happening. Then calm, concentration, and equanimity arise. And these are the things that balance out these first four, in a sense. And when all seven factors are active, that's when deep intuitive insight arises. This is the place where, if all seven of these factors are operating, and you can actually experience all seven of them at once, which is kind of interesting, that leads to deeper insight into the nature of everything. That's where this practice is headed, in a sense, for all of us. So, and that's really all I have to say about this. I think and I wanted to talk about this because I think it's important to talk about not only where the practice is today, but where it's headed. This is where we're all headed, to experiencing, knowing these seven factors of awakening. They're part of the practice. This is something the Buddha talked about all the time in the In the Satipatthana Sutta, which is where I'm most familiar with this, these things occur in other suttas. In the Satipatthana Sutta, at the very last stages of the practice, where he's basically describing the progressive steps in meditation practice, the only step beyond the seven factors of awakening is having an intuitive understanding of the Four Noble Truths. That's it. These seven factors are active, and then you start to understand at some intuitive level the truth of the Four Noble Truths, as opposed to the intellectual level. That's what leads to enlightenment. So this is good stuff, interesting, fascinating. And all of us can, it's not like this is like a, I don't want to make this sound like a really advanced practice, because all of us can experience this at some level, at some stage, and maybe only briefly. But if we see it arising and then we note it, it's great stuff. Noting, remember, I keep coming back to noting, but actually noting, acknowledging, yeah, this is what's actually happening right now, is a very powerful way to keep your practice going. You know, it's the danger of this practice in the broadest sense is that we only notice all the bad stuff. Oh, I'm full of anger today. Oh, I'm full of lust today. Oh, this, oh, that. And we never acknowledge all the great stuff that's also arising, and acknowledge it, accept it, enjoy it. That's what makes you want to keep practicing in the long, over the long term. Okay. Having said all that, let's spend some time sitting again. So yeah, we'll sit for another half hour, and then we'll have some time at the end after that for questions, comments, criticism, witticism, etc. So as always, find your comfortable upright position. Settle in. Try to have no expectations at all of what's going to happen. Remember, that's the first step of beginner's mind we talked about, having no expectations. Yeah. These seven factors arising is just a matter of us creating the causes and conditions so that mindfulness arises, and then as mindfulness is established, these factors just start arising one after another. You know, we can't force it. We can't expect it to happen. They just happen. I'll shut off my mic now. So there's only one more thing, well, one more thing for now, a few closing remarks, but I want to say that nice, calm, still space you're in right now, after a day of practice, and you all have hung in and worked really hard, it's very clear to me, enjoy it. It's really important that you go, and just enjoy the sweetness of the calm and the still and the concentration. And if that hasn't been your experience today, maybe some people have had, maybe you've had a tough day, it's kind of hard for me to tell at the moment, but I'll maybe find out more in a minute. Then enjoy the fact that even though it was a tough day, you stuck it, you hung in there and practiced, which is also very skillful. So at this point, what I'd like to do is sort of open the floor to people having something to say. And this could take several different forms. One is maybe you have some questions. Maybe for all the stuff I said all day long, maybe there's a few questions that have arisen over the course of the day and you'd like to ask a question or two, and that's perfectly fine. It's wonderful. I'm also very appreciative of people letting me know basically how this all went. Was this useful? Did you actually see any shift in your practice given what I was saying? Did it make sense to you? Did it have some reality for you? That sort of feedback is very useful for me as a teacher. And lastly, maybe you just want to share some particular experience, something that happened during the day, wonderful, not so wonderful, whatever, and just share it and let us all know that that's what happened. That's all of those would be fine. So what you should do is if you want to speak, just turn on your mic. I'm not gonna do the hands up. There's only 6-7 people here. But if you want to speak, just turn on your mic and start talking. And then when you're finished, someone else will turn on their mic and start talking. And if nobody wants to talk, and I understand, don't feel at all any pressure to speak. I mean, often at the end of a day of sitting, the last thing you want to do is start talking. And that's perfectly all right. Don't feel at all obliged to do anything. But if you do want to speak, go right ahead.
So I want to thank you for a great retreat. I did this retreat last year, this month. And so in my mind, I can compare how I feel today as opposed then to then. And the things you taught me last January, I've been implementing them. And I can see how much growth I've done. And I really appreciate it. I'm so much more calm, and the sitting and walking sessions went so much more easily this time. So thank you.
Good. I'm glad that's the case. In fact, it makes me very happy to hear that that's the case, but that's partly a result of me and partly a result of you doing a lot of practice. And so please acknowledge that's mainly you and just a little bit of me there.
Thank you.
Other people. So, Adrian, could you turn off your mic when you're finished? Anyone else?
I just want to thank you as well. My practice has been a little bumpy lately, and I feel that today, between the talks and the practice and the walking, that I think I'm back on track now, and had a really, really good day. I just want to thank you.
Good. Well, that's the value of retreat. Retreat sort of, you know, I like to say like just daily practice is like putting gas in the car, and retreat's like, let's get an oil change and a lube job and, you know, sort of do a little more to sort of get things going. And yeah. And so retreats are very valuable for that. And to be honest with you, I get the same benefit myself. I get a whole day of practice. This is great. So thank you as well.
Hi, Barry.
Hi.
Thanks for the retreat. So I probably have like 2 or 3 questions.
Sure. Go ahead.
Because I always have a lot. So let's see. First thing I want to ask about is, you were talking about something that was the anecdote to doubt.
Or the antidote.
Antidote. Was that the investigation?
Yeah.
Thing.
Yes.
Could you talk more about that? Because, so, what I struggle with sometimes is, how do I know what's happening is like really what's happening, or am I just making stuff up in my head?
Doubt in self is what that's called. And that's one of the 3 forms of doubt and the most difficult to work with. And the reason Dhammapachaya is considered the antidote to doubt is because you start to see really clearly the Buddha's teachings sort of coming to life in your practice. You start to see, as I said, not just the details of what's arising, but the underlying process starts to show itself really clearly. And it's that's what takes away the doubt, because now it's like, this practice actually makes sense, because you're seeing the teachings actually, the core teachings come alive in your practice. And that's why it tends to make that. As far as your question, am I experiencing what I should be experiencing? Should I believe it?
Yeah, should I believe it?
That's judgment. So when you catch yourself going there, just no judging, self-judging. You're assuming you know what's supposed to happen, which you don't. Nobody does. You're just practicing and something's happening. And sometimes it feels great. And sometimes you have an insight into something. And sometimes it's just one of those days. And it's all okay. I've had whole retreats that were one of those days. So, I mean, when I'm talking about a month of just like one of those days, one after another. So it's like, don't worry about it. Don't judge it. Just like, oh, yeah, I'm practicing and I can see because that investigation is energized, which it sounds like it is in you, I'm starting to see deeper into this practice. Perfect. End of discussion. No need to judge anything.
Because sometimes I go into judging other people. Okay. So another question I have, you were talking about acceptance.
Yeah.
We're powerless over things, circumstances. What I heard was the only power we have is of our own reaction to things.
Of how skillfully react, not just react, but that we're reacting skillfully. We're not getting caught in the, you know, the anger or the fear or the desire or whatever. We're not being hooked by it. We're just seeing it for what it is. Ah, there's my old friend doubt arising yet again. Isn't that interesting? And that's okay.
But sometimes don't we have, isn't it okay to be angry?
Well, it's okay to experience anger because that means you're a normal person. What's not okay is to be caught by it and then act out into the world from there. That's what we're trying to learn to do. So the skillful reaction to anger is to go, ah, there's anger. Yeah, my old friend, I know this. You can feel it in the body. Drop down into the body and sort of feel the heat and the sort of the shakiness of it. Note all that, but don't take it out into the world. And don't take it out on yourself. Don't self-blame for that either. That's because that's just a normal human emotion that arises. It's the accepting it and saying, and that's okay.
Okay. Yes. And we don't have to necessarily do anything about it at that moment.
No.
But maybe sometime we might need to. For instance, if someone's mistreating us.
Ah. Well, that's but you can deal with that without anger. You can deal with that by sort of, you know, let the anger cool down and then deal with that.
Oh, okay. It's not like we have to stuff it or just say, hey, everything's okay.
No, not at all.
And sorry, I don't want to monopolize the whole thing, but you were talking too about how, you know, we're all having to deal with this pandemic.
Yeah.
You know, you have to stay at home. I can't see my friends. I can't do activities that I used to love to do. And so, I mean, a good thing that came out of it is I'm a lot less busy than I used to be. I used to be too busy.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how to counteract it. Well,
yeah.
It's been done for me. So that's one blessing out of it. But then on the other hand, when you were talking, you were saying something like, hey, this is the pandemic or whatever it is, whatever the situation is, okay, we have to accept it and it's okay. But really, it's not okay. Sometimes it's not okay.
It's okay on the level of, it's not okay that thousands of people are getting sick and dying. That's not okay. That's not what I meant by when I said that's okay.
No, I know that. Yeah.
What's okay? What I meant by that is that this is what is. I mean, this is our life right now. Our life is like this, and we can either fight against it and go, oh, it's not fair, and I wish it wasn't this way, and or we can go, well, this is what I got right now, and that's okay. That's what I meant by that's okay. That is like, there's nothing I can do to change this. I can't right. magically make the pandemic go away.
Right.
So I can either accept it and be okay with it, or I can get frustrated and angry and upset. Which one sounds better to you?
The first one, of course.
Okay. Good.
Thank you.
Okay. Good. Other, yeah. Janice, you're waving your hand there.
Yes. Speaking of the pandemic, it made me think a little bit about what you had said about control, especially in our society as well as in our private lives, and how deeply we've been taught to value seeking control over really everything. And one thing that occurred to me about the pandemic is that we've been really enormously lucky in terms of the fact we could develop a vaccine this quickly, and it is getting rolled out. And compared with, you know, 100, 200 years ago, when thousands and thousands of people would be dying from the measles or smallpox or whatever, I get the impression that as societies, in some ways, we've really, through technology, particularly medical technology, we've really assumed a lot more control over what happens than, you know, our poor ancestors. Who many times didn't even have enough to eat. And I also wonder if we've come to expect that as time goes on, things will get better and better, and we'll be getting more and more control over our lives. And I was curious as to any response you might have to that, the expectation of just getting more and more control.
Depends what you mean by better. And because there's two ways that we could think of that. It could be better in the sense of, like, as you were describing, our material lives and our health system and all those things are better. Yeah, yeah. That's probably going to continue. Though who knows? I mean, maybe, you know, a comet's going to hit the Earth and we're all going to go back to the Dark Ages. I mean, who knows? We don't. But generally, it seems to be moving in that direction. But whether or not having that material benefit makes the world better, I think it's an open question. Mm-hmm. Because look what's going on in the world right now. And look what's going on in this country right now. Doesn't seem better to me on that level, mm-hmm. on the level of society and level of Dharma.
Sure.
So it's, so I don't, it's one of those six of one, half a dozen of the other questions, I think, or at least my answer to that question is very wishy-washy, I know, but that's.
I guess the other part of my question was, do you think that we've been conditioned to expect that we will continue to acquire more control over our lives? And do you think we expect it more than somebody was living 300 years ago in Germany, let's say?
Okay. I think what's increasing is our delusion that we think we have control.
Okay.
Or that we should have. Like, that delusion is getting stronger sometimes, I think. But I think the actual fact is we've never had any control, and we never will.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Over the basics of what's arising in our lives right now today. That's just like, you know, the Buddha talked about it 2,500 years ago. It's no different then than it is now.
Mm-hmm.
That hasn't changed at all. That's the beauty of the Buddha's teachings, is that they are eternal in that sense. They're talking about human nature in its root form, which doesn't change, I don't think.
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Barry.
Yeah, Rex, go ahead.
Hi. Good day today. Thank you very much. Glad I did it. Ajahn Sumedho said a line that has been one of my favorites for a long time, and it's letting go is leaving things as they are. And, you know, it pretty much sums up a lot of today. Letting go can be a tricky thing. Like, it's like, oh, just let it go. You know, it's no big deal. Just let, well, letting go, leaving things as they are, it's a, like a full circle.
Yeah.
It makes letting go easier, I think, if it ever can be easy. But I've always loved that line. It's interesting that you brought him up today. Not that I'm a devotee. I don't know that much about him, but I'm going to continue to read more because I've read many lines that are great like that. But letting go is leaving things as they are.
Sounds like beginner's mind to me.
Yes, it does, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thanks everyone else that attended today. It was fun.
Yeah. Were you waving your hand, Deb?
Yes, I just wanted to thank you for taking some very complex, in some ways, ideas and making them very practical and accessible. You have a very nice way of, just a very down-to-earth and clear way of sharing your teaching. And I appreciate that. And I also appreciate the very human examples that you give. I always feel like the thoughts that come up for me are okay because I don't need to, because everyone has them, you know. And so anyway, thank you.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for the feedback. That's very useful for me to know that what I'm trying to do is actually working. Because a lot of people who teach Dhamma in the West are therapists, and there's a certain, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but there's a certain, you know, therapeutic flavor to how they teach. I'm a carpenter. So I teach from this very sort of practical, real world, this is how things are way, because that's how I experience life. So it's nice to know that what I'm trying to do is actually getting across. I appreciate that. Okay, so, excuse me. I want to just very briefly, so the last thing I want to do, of course, is read a poem. I can't do anything without reading poetry. This is from Mary Oliver's book, Evidence. And it's called Mysteries. Yes. Truly, we live with mysteries too marvelous to be understood. How grass can be nourishing in the mouths of lambs. How rivers and stones are forever in allegiance with gravity, while we ourselves dream of rising. How two hands touch and the bonds will never be broken. How people come from delight or the scars of damage to the comfort of a poem. Let me keep my distance always from those who think they have the answers. Let me keep company always with those who say, look, and laugh in astonishment and bow their heads. That's beginner's practice defined as far as I'm concerned. So let's just dedicate the merit. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.